accession number 19921, reel 3.
Glenhill, reel 3.
Captain Armour said not for us not to go through D Company that night, and there was a man called Captain Thompson who used to get dressed up as a Burmese, and he had some Burmese scouts with him. I can't remember the name of the group they formed, but this group used to infiltrate the Japanese area dressed as Burmese. The Burmese were Burmese, but Captain Thompson was British, but he used to get dressed up as a Burmese in charge of these people. And they used to go and mingle with the Japanese in villages in Burma. And I think that he must have passed information about the Japs attacking that night because of the way that the Japs were concentrating in front of our battalion. In fact, I remember that one night previous to this, our signal officer, Captain Weiberg, was confronted by Captain Thompson. I think his name is Captain Thompson. And Captain Weiberg was dubious about who he was, the way he was dressed. And he was asking to see our commanding officer. And he pulled his revolver on him, Captain Weiberg. And he had his pistol aimed at him because he couldn't believe who he was. Anyway, he didn't shoot him, but he finally took him to see Colonel Cree. And that is, I think, how we used to get information about the Japanese, because of these Burmese scouts. I know that is a fact. These things happen, and he must have been a very brave man to go walking about among the Japanese in the villages, mingling with ordinary Burmese people, of course. And then I didn't get to the guerrilla platoon. I was told to go straight back to Battalion HQ, and Henry Ford and I went back. And it was a bit of a rough night, that. But we were used to it. You get so used to these things that you don't think much about it, you know. Nobody wants to get killed, but on the other hand, I mean, you take it all in your stride. So, one day, it would be probably the last day in January 1944, when after we'd had our breakfast, the signal officer, he said, the battalion is on notice to be ready to move in an hour's notice. We don't know what the hour will be, but he said, we must be ready when that time arrives. Now, he didn't tell us what was happening. I don't know whether he knew himself. But he said, I want you to get all the telephone lines reeled in as quick as you can. He said, because apart from reeling all the lines in, we've got to get the signal equipment ready, because this is going to be a move by mule. And the mules will be coming with the panniers, and these panniers have got to be evenly balanced on either side of the mule. So off you go, get the lines reeled in. So we went out, and there were about four or five of us. I went to, I don't know what company now, but we got these lines reeled in. And when we'd reeled them in, we had to then pack the panniers up, because the mules had arrived by this time. It was about 10 o'clock when the mules arrived. And we still didn't know what hour was going to be for us to move. There were all the blankets to roll up, ground sheets and everything, all our own equipment, and all the signal equipment, wireless sets and everything. I think our job was just about as bad as anybody's in the battalion when it came to a thing like that, because of our equipment. In fact, I remember one sergeant major. It was not in the signal platoon at all. It had nothing to do with the signals. He said to one young man who'd just arrived and not been with us all that long, he says, "Do you realise that you're in the best platoon in the battalion?" And I looked at him. I laughed. He says, "I'm telling you." So I thought, well, at least I think we're all right. So anyway, we got our things ready, and we were ready for tiffin time. And then about 1:30, order came for us to be ready to move in an hour. So we were ready, of course. Now this was the move into the admin box. We didn't know that we were going into the admin box. It wasn't called the admin box then, anyway. The battle of the admin box was originally what we called the Battle of the Knackydoke Pass. Now, when we were given the orders to set off, we set off following the mules, and we gradually climbed up into the hills. There were small mountains, not proper hill mountains as if you could imagine, but small hills, and it was the foothills of the Mayo Range. And when we got up to the top of this area, we then turned left, and we came to a track that had been hacked out of the jungle, probably about the width of this room, enough to get a mule through, men walking at the side. And we walked on there, kept on going on this track that had been knocked out of the jungle. And then we gradually went going down into this valley. And we finally arrived in the Knackydoke Pass around about 7:30. And it was pitch black. No moon. It was absolutely pitch black. You couldn't hardly see in front of you. Now, the cooks had set off, all the cooks in the different companies on the HQ had set off before us, and they'd got a meal ready for us. It must have been well planned, because the meal was ready. It was only bully stew, but at least it was a meal, and we were ready for it, and a pot of tea. Now, we had our meal, and we were told what was going to happen. There was between 8,000 and 9,000 Japanese going to attack this area in preparation for an attack onto India. And they had been given 10 days to capture this area of the Knackydoke Pass. Now, we sorted ourselves out that night into our own platoon. We knew what to do. So two of us said, right, we'll do our, we'll stamp to. I'll do 2 hours, you do 2 hours, and that as it was all night. But we knew, we'd done it that often, we used to do it, unthinking. And the following morning, when we got organised, I was sent to C Company, and as a signaller. And the Japs were expecting to come from the east. Now, there was two tracks that crossed each other around about the Knackydoke Pass. One track north to south, the other from east to west, and the Japs are coming from east to west to take this area. It was, you won't know Bradford, but I always think about Bradford. The area from the bottom of Bolton Road across Foster Square and across Townhall Square, because Bradford's in like a hollow with hills all around, and I always think about that when I think about the Knackydoke Pass. Because that was as it was. And that was the area what we were in. Not a big area. But when we understood that we'd been detached from 5th Division, 5th Indian Division, to rejoin and be attached to the 7th Indian Division, which was inland. Now their echelon, B echelon, the rear echelon of 7th Indian Division, they were where we were, and apart from us, and I believe there might have been some Gurkhas I know there were some Gurkhas. But really speaking, we were going to be outnumbered by between 7 and 8 to 1 by the Japanese. We were told this. So I reckon that Captain Thompson probably gleaned a lot of this information from our corps commander, who got the whiff of it all, what was going on. And he organised some tanks to go into the Nakedoke Pass. Some British tanks. I think they were General Grant tanks. And they were hidden under the trees. Now, none of us knew this at the time. And I was attached to C Company, and C Company were occupying some positions down the east track where the Japs were coming from. Now, after the second day, we started getting shelling. Shelling began to come, mortars and what have you. And some of the Jap mortars were fairly heavy. They sounded worse than what they were, because I suppose that the echoes were reverberating through the hills, you know, in the valleys and that, and it probably sounded worse than what it really was. But anyway, after about 3 days, C Company was moved. We were asked to move to a hill overlooking the area where we come in on this track. And it was up at the top of a cliff from that side, but there was a path up round the other side. And we made our positions up there, and I was with C Company Commander Captain Roach. We dug our trenches, and I was next to him with the wireless set and that. There were only 2 signallers at the finish. A lad from Wigan, they called him Jimmy Kelly. We had 2 Jimmy Kellys. One was a Jimmy Kelly from Bradford, and this was a Jimmy Kelly from Wigan. We were on that hill for about a week. But anyway, one particular morning, I went down to HQ. And I'd been to HQ, and I came back up the hill, and all of a sudden I hear the screaming of aero engines. I thought, dive bomber, because we'd been dive bomber on the desert. And there was a trench nearby, empty trench, and I dived straight in it. At the bottom of the hill, there was an anti-aircraft gun with the crew. And this dive bomb must have been aiming for this, but of course, naturally, you're thinking, is this bomb coming for me? But the bomb, I heard it screaming down, and it got a direct hit on the on this anti-aircraft gun and killed all the gun crew. And then it came again, and it dropped its second bomb, just the same. And I heard the plane fly away. And then I got out of the trench and went to the bottom of the hill. And, well, it was carnage, really. There were people there who must have been nearer than me, actually, to it, and they were organising what they could. There's not much chance for the men who were hit at all. And I remember Henry Ford mentioning it to me about it. He remembers it very well. And I went back up the hill, and I told Captain Roach what had happened, and we couldn't do anything. But anyway, we occupied the hill. And then we were just below the brow of the hill, Captain Roach and myself and the signaller. We were just below the brow of the hill. And one morning I'd been doing from 4 till 6 on duty. And Jimmy had been trying to get some sleep in another trench. So at 6 o'clock, I said to Jimmy, at 6 o'clock, Jim, he said, I'm coming, Dick. He said, right, I'm coming. So there'd been some sporadic firing going on. Now, when he took over from me, and I thought, well, I might get an hour's sleep. I don't suppose I will, but I'll see. There'd been some sporadic firing going on, and around about 7 o'clock, a 7:15, Captain Roach said to Jimmy Kelly, I want you to go up there on the... and see, what do they call his name? Mr. So-and-so, he was a lieutenant. He said, see what all this sporadic firing's about. Well, that's the last time I saw Jimmy Kelly alive. I felt shocking about this. I did. Because, I mean, I know it could have been me, but I felt it. I was so sorry about Jimmy. He was older than me, and he hadn't been in the single platoon all that long, really. But I reckon he'd be, whilst I was about 24 at the time, he'd be about, he must have been turned 30, and I felt really sorry because he was married and all that. Now, that's the last time I saw Jimmy Kelly alive. He came from Wigan. And we didn't, they couldn't understand why a machine gun was firing down on the hill where the RLC company were dug in. And it appeared, and it was, that a Japanese soldier had climbed one of the biggest trees in the area with a rope. And when he climbed up as high as he possibly could to look down on the hill, he lowered the rope down, they tied a machine gun to it, plus a load of ammunition, and he dragged it all up, and then he got himself ready, and he started firing down on the hill. And this is how the Japanese captured the hill. Because at the other side of the hill, it was a gradual slope up. And I always thought, to myself, it's vulnerable, is that? This was before we were attacked. 3 or 4 days, I thought, this is very vulnerable for attackers this side. And it transpired. And there were quite a number of men killed and very badly wounded. In fact, I remember Sammy Lyons, the C Company's sergeant major, he was very badly wounded all down his right arm. And he came running past us. He was shouting, "They're Japanese bastards." And, you know, and there were quite a number wounded, but quite a lot killed as well. But it was because of this Japanese machine gunner. They were very wily with the Japanese, you know. Anyway, we realised, Captain Roach and myself, that there was nobody else up there but us. So he said to me, Captain Roach said, "Can you see anybody else around about here? Is anybody else with us or what?" I said, "I can see 3 pairs of boot soles facing me. They're looking that way, are the men." So he said, "Right." He said, "Well, will you go across and tell those men to make their way to the bottom of the hill? But they must walk, they've not to run." I said, "Yes." So I doubled up and I scrambled through the bushes and what have you. And I said, "You've got to go to the bottom of the hill, but you've got to walk, you've not to run." Right, so off they went. Of course, by this time, what time would it be? I mean, might have been about just after 9 o'clock. So I went back to Captain Roach and we got back in our trench and I had my rifle ready in case the Japs... But they didn't bother coming. I couldn't understand it. You'd have thought they'd have been all over the place. But they were laughing and singing and talking and all this sort of thing. Oh, so glad they captured this hill. Well, we stayed there for... 20 minutes, just like that. And he said to me, to Captain Roach, "Well, Glad Hill," he said, "I can't see that we can do much more up here." He said, "We may as well go to the bottom of the hill, but we're walking, we're not running." I said, "Right, yes, sir, right." So I got my kit ready. I mean, I closed the wireless set down anyway. We had the telephone line to use if we wanted it. And I disconnected the telephone from the line and packed the wireless set up and got my blankets together, and off I went to the bottom of the hill with Captain Roach following me. And then we formed up at the bottom of the hill and we got undercover best way we could. Now, previous to that, I'd forgot about this, but previous to that, I'd mentioned about the tanks being moved into the Knockydoke Pass. Now, I didn't know there were any tanks there until about 3 days previously, when I'd been on a path, and I saw all these tanks under camouflage. Ooh, I thought, that's good. Gives you a bit of a boost, you know, at least you've got something. Not just rifles and bayonets. So I walked past all these tanks. I spoke to the tank drivers and what have you, and Father Honor went, and there was a mountain gun that was under camouflage, and I didn't even know it was there. It was so well camouflaged. And they began firing this mountain gun. I was only as near as what I am to you. Nearly deafened me. And, oh, I thought, let me get out of here. I mean, I wouldn't have got so close, but they began firing this mountain gun. There were an Indian unit who was manning the gun. And I went back. But that afternoon, when we came down the hill, Captain Roach and I, around about 4:15, these tanks lined up in an opening at the bottom of the hill. There was a big opening at the bottom of the hill, with no trees on it at all. And these tanks lined up, plus the battalion mortars, 3-inch mortars. And at around about 4:15, the order was given, fire. Well, the tanks opened up with their guns, the main armament, plus Browning machine guns. And they were firing tracer. And they were all firing tracer. And with our battalion mortars, they plastered the hill that we'd occupied. And one of the mortars got a direct hit on this machine gunner, knocked him clean out. So it went on for about 3/4 of an hour, did this attack. And then they set ceasefire. So I believe it was A Company, either A or B Company, who were going to counterattack this hill. And I thought, well, I'm going with them. And I didn't say a word to anybody. I did say to one or two of the lads, I'm going with them, because I'm going to look for Jimmy Kelly. So I went up with them, and I don't recall a shot being fired, as it happened. Naturally, we thought there'd be some resistance, but there wasn't any resistance at all because of the plastering of shells and mortar bombs that they'd got up there. And so when I got to the top of the hill, I looked for Jimmy Kelly. Among them, they were dead all over the place, Japanese dead in hours. And Jimmy was laid half in and half out of a trench. And I thought, oh, you know, nothing we could do about it, obviously. But there we are. And that was one of the worst things for me in the that I felt for anybody in that Battle of the Admin Box. Now, we still called it the Battle of the Nacogdoches Pass. Field Marshal Mountbatten, he was the Southeast Asia commander of all the area. And at the beginning of this attack on the Nacogdoches Pass, he realised that we were going to be in a right dire straits as regards food, ammunition, medical supplies, because we were cut off completely. Couldn't get through. So he commandeered a lot of aircraft, including some American aircraft, to drop us supplies. And this is how we succeeded in defeating the Japanese, because the Japanese had been given 10 days to capture this area. And after that, they had to live off the land. Now, we found when we went to the top, back to the top of the hill, we looked in the Japanese packs, you know, the haversacks that they had of the dead, and they'd all our food, tins of corned beef, sugar, you name it. And they'd pick this up from various places that they'd captured, you see, and stores and what have you. So Admiral Mountbatten ordered this aircraft to come and drop us supplies, which he did. Some did fall into Japanese hands, but of course we got the majority. In fact, one morning before we got these supplies, I looked at a crust of bread in my hand and I thought to myself, and how long is that going? Am I going to have to last on that? But of course I needn't have worried. And unknown to me again, my cousin Norman, who lives at Rose, an outskirts of Bradford, he knew I was down there. He was in the aircraft, one of the aircraft dropping supplies. He told me after. I said, he said, I knew you were down there. They must have known the West Yorks were in there, somewhere or other. And he was in the RAF. I said, you never did. He said, I'm telling you, I knew. He says that when I were dropping you supplies, I knew you were there. So there we are. So that was part of it. But eventually, the Japanese were worn down. Now, our RSM had been the HQ Company Sergeant Major. He was now the RSM. Now, he organised a group of men to throw grenades onto a certain area of a Chong, which was a dried-up riverbed. Now, the Japanese had had instructions that they had to rendezvous at this particular Chong. Now, they're a bit daft, the Japanese, you know. If they're given orders, they stick to these orders irrespective, rigidly. They will not change their ideas. If things aren't going right, they'll still persist in doing what they've been told to do. And our men under the RSM, Maloney, they were throwing grenades onto these Japs as they arrived in this Chong, and they killed, I don't know how many Japs. But they still kept on coming, the Japs, irrespective. In fact, the RSM won the Distinguished Conduct Medal, DCM, for what he'd done. And he also, we couldn't get a line out to them, and he was shouting orders. He had a smashing voice. He would have right. You can imagine on a barrack square, shouting orders. Well, he was shouting orders to the mortar platoon on where to fire the mortars onto this Chong. And his voice carried marvellously, and they could hear every word he said. In fact, we had to laugh, you know, even though things were very serious. But he did a marvellous job, did RSM Maloney. And as I say, won the DCM. Eventually, we must have been wearing the Japanese down because they weren't winning it at all. And this battle went on all the month of February until about the 26th, 7th or 8th. I can't remember the exact day, but it went on for the month of February, for 28 days practically. And the Japanese still hadn't won. Now, they must have been getting fed up or worn out or whatever. They had no food. They couldn't get supplies. They must have been running out of ammunition, medical supplies, which they didn't probably worry about, and most of them probably could have had malaria or typhus or whatever. So, one morning, and it was the last day of the siege of the admin box, I saw the signal officer at the other side of the perimeter where I was. And they were all around in a circle, more or less, in this perimeter. And I watched him walk from that side, and he passed about between 6 and 8 signallers. And he came straight across to us, over at this side, and there were about 6 or 8 more signallers here. And he walked straight up to me. He said, I want you to get a wireless set. And I want you to walk down that track and report back what you see. Now, he'd never told me that our battalion commander or anybody had said that we think the Japanese may have pulled out. Because the very first thought I had when he said, I wanted to walk down that track and report back what you see with the wireless set, I thought, what, me on my own? Now, this thought flashed through my mind, and all I said to him was, right, sir. I just said, right, sir. I thought, again. Oh, and as I turned away to get a wireless set from Charlie Jennings, who was the wireless stowman, the signal stowman, he said, oh, you'll be accompanied by 2 armed men. So I said, right, sir. That's the only 2 words I said on both occasions. Now, I thought, if I'd have been a Jap commander pulling out and withdrawing, and I'd have had between 8...